Okay, it's time. It's 9 o'clock, so let's begin. It's December 9th, 2013. This is the fourth class, I believe, on Rabbi Yecheskel Abramsky, and we're going to continue, maybe even finish tonight, dealing with his biography, his life. I'm presenting what I think is the mainstream view in scholarship of Dayan Abramsky at the end, which I don't think will come today, probably the beginning. I will present what I think is really a new interpretation, and I mean, I guess it's a correct interpretation also, by Benjamin Elton in this book, Britain's Chief Rabbis and the Religious Character of Anglo-Jewry, that came out 4 years ago. And he offers a little different perspective on Rabbi Yecheskel Abramsky and the Chief Rabbinate than I've been giving. But I'll get to that at the end and tell you what his contribution. I mean, everyone who writes a book, they have to add something, say something new. So his job in this book was to present the alternative approach, where he thinks the scholarship, the historiography has gone wrong. So we'll do that, I think, next class. Okay, before we start, Yisrael's been asking me a few times to show the grave of Rabbi Chaim Hirschenson, that the tombstone that Yecheskel Moskowitz, is one of our listeners, not here tonight. He had asked me where the grave was, and I looked it up, as I mentioned. It's in Riverside Cemetery in Saddlebrook, New Jersey. I believe it's Bergen County. If you're looking at the map, it's not far from Teaneck, Hackensack, Bergenfield, those places. I can give anyone who's interested, if you want to see it, the details, where exactly it is. But you can. There's lots of other important rabbis buried there as well. We had, I think it was 5 classes on Rav Chaim Hirschenson. You could see how he is described here. Harav, Hagon, Etzadik, Er Hador, Chacham B'Sofer, you know, the great names say that he was the rabbi in Hoboken and the Jersey City Heights, Union City area, etc. For 30 years. So there it is, Yisrael. I could send you your own copy of it if you want. A couple other things before we start. I was asked by Scott Berman, who's here right now, to say something more about Rav Avadya Yosef. Those of you who are in Toronto, I'll actually be speaking about him this Thursday night. But his question is that other themes that characterize his tshuvot. I spoke about meeting the needs of the community, halacha has to be inclusive, and someone has already asked me to continue the classes on Rav Avadya, you know, in a few, maybe next semester, to, you know, finish up with his life, where I would talk in more detail. But let me just say right now, Scott also says, are there predictable approaches in his responsa? Does he have an approach in learning? He does have. Well, first of all, he is lenient, almost exclusively, not exclusively. I mean, no real poseg is always lenient. I mean, his opposition to shadels, which was consistent from his early years, is one example of astringency. But to speak a little technically for a minute here, he works with this idea, in theory at least, that the Shulchan Aruch, everything has to be decided according to the Shulchan Aruch. So that leads him to reject all sorts of practices in the Sephardic world that were acceptable. Everything from, you know, in the Sephardic world, you had plenty of women who made a bracha on a mitzvah sesachias mangrama, a time-bound commandment, like a lulav. There are plenty of women who do like the Ashkenazim, that is, light the candles, Shabbos candles, and then make the bracha. So he tried to overturn all that. However, in reality, in the Shulchan, he doesn't always follow the Shulchan Aruch. And I don't want to use, when I say he manipulates the halacha, I don't mean in a negative sense. I mean it just as an external way of looking at it, because Rav Avadya operates on this assumption that when you have, even though in theory, the Shulchan Aruch is absolutely binding, he also holds 2 other positions. One of them is that if early authorities that the Shulchan Aruch did not see were then published, you say that had the Shulchan Aruch seen them, he would have altered his position. That's one way that he's not bound to the Shulchan Aruch. But the most important way is a notion called Sfek Sveka. A Sfek Sveka is a double doubt. That is, there's a doubt about this aspect of the halacha and a doubt about that aspect. And when you think of it, and when I say manipulate, what I mean is that in almost every area of halacha, there's going to be a dispute. And since you can assume, as Rav Avadya does, that if there is a dispute, that creates suffek number one, doubt number one, it's not so difficult to get to a double suffek, a double doubt, which means that the Shulchan Aruch can even be pushed aside. Now, how and when Rav Avadya Yosef decides to go against the Shulchan Aruch, even though in theory he's not supposed to, that's something we can take up more at another time. Let me just give you one example of this, to show you that this idea that he always follows the Shulchan Aruch is not correct. In other words, you can manipulate it, again, not in a bad way, but the halakhic system can be used in a certain way that you can by using the Sfek Sfeika, you can arrive at a different answer than you would expect. Here's a perfect example. I think most people know that there's a prohibition of a non-Jew cooking for Jews. It's called Bishul Akum. There's different heterim, ways of permission. For example, the most obvious one, which is pretty much found in every single restaurant, is that if a Jew lights the pilot light, then the Jew has a role in it. There are also other permissions, other heterim, not all of which are accepted, but for example, there is a view of medieval authorities that at least one medieval authority, if someone's working for you, there's no prohibition on Bishul Akum because you have to have sort of Bishul Akum. The fear was that it would lead to socialization, marriages, things like that. If someone's working for me, it's a different sort of relationship, especially in the olden days. Today, maybe not so, but if you had one of these servant girls working for you, there wasn't such a concern. There's also there's at least one posek, I'm sure there's others, who feels that there's no issue of Bishul Akum in industrial style things. So, for example, we don't need to be concerned if you buy a product in the store, a packaged product, a Bishul Akum, because this thing was cooked, it was cooked in a factory. Who knows where this factory is? And since we have no relationship with them, then how could there be an issue of Bishul Akum? Others say it doesn't matter. Lo plug. The rabbis made this decree, and even though I'm never going to meet the person who's cooking this, so that's the Ashkenazic approach, though, that as long as the Jew has some involvement with it, that's the standard approach, it's not an issue. Sfardim, however, don't accept that. Standard approach of Sfardim, the Shulchan Aruch's approach, is that simply having a non-Jew light the flame is not enough. So Rav Avadya Yosef is asked, well, what about if you're invited over someone's house for a meal? Or if you're at an event, actually it's an event, house would be the same, but if you're at an event, for example, can Sfardim go to any of our simchas? Because at our simchas, they rely on this. And Rav Avadya says, yes, you can. Why can you? Even though the Shulchan Aruch says you're not allowed to. A Sfardi is not allowed to eat food that was cooked, if it wasn't completely cooked by the Jew, if it was only cooked by if the Jew only lit the flame. And yet Rav Avadya says you can. Now, I think it's obvious that he's looking at the fact that Kol Yisrael is an important factor. And you can't have a situation where Ashkenazim and Sfaradim at Simchas can't eat together. Or restaurants or things like that. His pesach applies to restaurants as well. So therefore, he wants to find a heter. Because how can you have a situation where Sfaradim can't eat at our affairs? We can't go out for dinner with them to the restaurants, of all the restaurants are under Ashkenazi Kashkacha, which is the case in America and Canada. So, but to that side, no question, it's motivating him. He doesn't say that, but I think it's obvious. He says the Sfardi can eat at this affair and eat at the restaurant. Well, how can he say this if the Shulchan Aruch says not? And he says you always have to follow the Shulchan Aruch, or he says there's a Sfek Sfeika, a double doubt. What's the doubt? Well, one of the doubts is that maybe the halacha is like the position that it's an employee, there's no issue of a Bishul Akum. Well, I mean, the Shulchan Aruch rejects that. And yet, nevertheless, Rav Avadya holds that you can use a suffik even against the Shulchan Aruch. Although if it's just one suffik, we don't hold of it, but it still counts as a suffik, so you can include it in the second one. And the second suffik is maybe you can light the candle. I mean, you can light the flame. So there you have two sfeikot, both of which the Shulchan Aruch rejects. And Rav Avadya says, nevertheless, you can apply the double suffix sfeika. And the result, the upshot, is that Sfardim don't need to follow the Shulchan Aruch in this. He says the same thing about the Glatt Kosher. Sfaradim have to eat Beis Yosef. That's the Pesach of the Shulchan Aruch. Not the Glatt that we have in America today, this phony Glatt, but real Glatt, where there's no adhesions. And yet Rav Avadia holds that if you're the same situation, you go to a restaurant, you invite to a house, at your home you should only have only Glatt, but if you go to someone else's house, you can eat it. Well, how can you if the Shulchan Aruch says not? So he says again, a sfek sfeika, the double suffix. Suffix number one, maybe the halacha is that this adhesion is kosher. You know, maybe the halacha is that you don't need to have a completely without adhesions. And number two, maybe this particular cow didn't have any adhesions to begin with. So here you see a perfect example of how Rav Avadia is able to use the halachic system to come to different conclusions. Now, in terms of a Zerach HaLimud, anyone who opens up his book will see that he overwhelms you with all the sources he quotes, which itself is a bit problematic because it's easy to see how if you're really adding up sources and you're concluding, in many cases, Rav Avadia will say that a certain position is to be rejected because Rabbi X disagrees with it. He doesn't feel he needs to show you why we reject it. Just if he shows you that there's, let's say, 10 great rabbis who reject it, that really is enough for him. And that's going to be one of the things when we do the next classes, I'll explain, which will be very problematic for the traditionalist Ashkenazi perspective. Because if you'd say to Rav Moshe Feinstein, for instance, that, you know, 10 Achronim disagree with you, his response is going to be, so what? Explain to me why I'm wrong. You know, why is my understanding of the Rambam wrong? So Rav Avadia, it's a more bekiyot oriented. There's no grand chidushim, no grand theories. It's really making small diukim and the principle of sfek sfeika is seen over and over again that you can build up these doubts. Ashkenazic poskim don't really create sfek sfeikas like that. Okay, Leia says a problem with sound. Before I go further, it's time to go on to Rabbi Hirschenson. Is anyone else having a problem with sound? Or is sound okay? Okay, we've been, if you're on wireless, it creates a sound problem, and sometimes it's just your local thing. We've been having very good sound, they tell me recently. Okay, let's go start with Rabbi Yechezkel Abramsky. The first thing I want to do is respond to Yisrael. He asked me last week what happened in Siberia, and I said I didn't really remember and that we don't really know anything, but I checked on it, and actually that's not correct. In the hagiography, page 209 and 210, it does speak a little bit about that Rabbi Yechezkel talked about when he, one of his jobs were to chop up, trees, pieces of a tree into smaller parts. He speaks a little bit about, just like two pages here, about what he was doing when he was sent to Siberia. I also want to say that I received an email from a figure I mentioned a couple classes ago, and it's really a big honor that he's listening to the classes. I have many people. I mean, we have now, 16 listening, but there's probably 60, 70 who listen in addition later in the car and everything, and I had no idea he was listening, and that was Diane Beanstalk. I mentioned him already as the only centrist Diane on the London-based, and Diane Beanstalk is a well-respected rabbi, community leader, and also Diane on the London-based today. So he's one of the leading post-scheme of London, and he's been listening to the classes, and being that he's a member of the London-based and he knows the inner scoop and everything, I have to be careful what I say, but thank you, Rabbi Beanstalk. As I said, it's a very big honor to have a Dayan and a renowned post-sec listening, and he did send a correction, so I thank him for that, but well, let me explain why I said what I said. I've been referring to Diane Abramsky as the head of the Beis Din, of Beis Din. And he did function unofficially as the leading figure of the Beis Din. He ran it. He was so I guess you could say he is the head of the Beis Din. I mean, the other figures didn't even come anywhere near him. He was the leading figure. However, officially, he was not the Av Beis Din. Rabbi Beanstalk writes, and which is correct, and I knew that, and I shouldn't have used the term Av Beis Din, but I'll tell you why I think I used it in a minute. He points out that technically his title was Senior Dayan, even though Rabbi Hertz did not usually sit on the Beis Din, when he did sit on the Beis Din, he was Av Beis Din. And other times, Dayan Abramsky would have been, in practice, the Av Beis Din, but he didn't have the title. In fact, it was only with Dayan Ehrenstroh that Rabbi Beanstalk mentions that they created this title, Rosh Beis Din, that he became. However, why I was saying that, well, first I was speaking not technically as Av Beis Din as much as how he functioned, because he did function as the leading figure. But I do have to say that I have seen him referred to Av Beis Din often, and maybe that's why I unthinkingly used the term. And lo and behold, I just looked a few minutes ago before I came on, in the collection of essays by Dayan Abramsky, which was published posthumously by his son, Menachem Ezra Abramsky in Israel. He has a timeline of his life, and this is right at the beginning, and he says, Tafresh Sadi Hei, Nitkabel Av Beis Din in London. So the son of Rabbi Abramsky, who I'm not going to say I knew him, but I spoke to him about his father, he passed away a few years ago, he lived in Israel, he refers to his father as Av Beis Din. Furthermore, the hagiography, which I'm holding in my hand here, I just pulled out the piece of paper here, but the hagiography, so I don't have the exact page number here, but the hagiography also, oh, here it is, those who want to check, I mean, the hagiography goes even further. The hagiography first refers to him on page 320 as Av Beis Din, London Rabati. So, I mean, the hagiography is calling him Av Beis Din. But they actually call him even more. They call him, the chapter is titled Bechirato the Rabba Shel London, his being appointed Rabbi of London, which was not correct at all. There was no such position as Chief Rabbi of London. They mean it may be the unofficial postake of London, but they refer to him as Av Beis Din as well. But thank you, Rabbi Beanstalk, for pointing out that that is not correct, that there was no technical title Av Beis Din. Rabbi Beanstalk has a few other points, which I will get to maybe in the next class. I want to answer him as well, his emails. He emailed me about this, quoting this book by Benjamin Elton, which I'm going to get to, about how to view Dayan Abramsky's appointment. But I'll get back to that. Okay, let us pick up where we were. I ended last class speaking about Rav Abramsky's appointment to the London Beis Din, the hindquarters controversy, and I once again advise anyone who wants to get more details on this controversy to listen to the classes on Rabbi Yitzhak Chanan Spector. I think now the deal is for a few dollars you get to download 50. We spoke in great detail about that. There were other problems, though, not just hindquarters, that, just before I go further, I mean, this whole controversy over hindquarters, it's hard to believe, but, I mean, the London Jewish population, they really wanted their sirloin and their tenderloin, and that was such an issue. But the hagiography report, this book, Melech Liofiel, reports another problem that Dayan Abramsky had with the Beis Din, and which needed to be fixed before he joined it, was that they had, or so we're told, maybe Dayan Beanstalk can weigh in on this, that they had a very lenient view when it came to conversions for the sake of marriage. I know today the London Beis Din has a more stringent view, and in fact they're regarded as sort of like a gold standard. No one questions their conversions, but we're told that they had a lenient view for marriage. And he wanted that fixed. Now, since that was his view, and I'm assuming it's correct what's stated here, I don't know how you bring this into line with something else he wrote. I'm holding in my hands now a responsum that Rabbi Abramsky wrote in 1922. He was in the Soviet Union, published in the Torah Journal that appeared in Europe, called Hatzvuna. And the issue was conversion for the sake of marriage. And in this responsum, that's a problem that all post-Jewish modern times have dealt with. What do you do when, it's usually with a man with a non-Jewish woman, but not always, can you convert the man or not? The problem is that we all know you're not supposed to convert someone for the sake of marriage, because it's not a you know, the person doesn't have the proper intentions. Let's say she really doesn't intend to accept the mitzvah, so she just wants to get married. I mean, that's one position. However, already the Rambam dealt with this question. There's a famous responsum of the Rambam in his responsa, Pe'er Hador, then later reprinted in other collections, in which he dealt with a man who was being intimate with his slave girl, and he wanted to convert her, and that's also not permitted. You're not allowed to convert just for that reason. And the Rambam says, although technically you're not allowed to, it's better for the Beis Din to sin, basically. I don't want to use the word sin, but to commit a small infraction in order for the larger good. In order to save this man from continuing to be intimate with the slave girl, which is a much higher level of problematics, better to convert the woman, even though it's not the best thing, and, you know, we don't tell people to do that, but that's the lesser of two evils. And the Rambam uses the language that, you know, this is what we do to help out Baalei Tshuva. Using the word Baal Tshuva, not like people use it today, someone who was irreligious and now becomes religious, but the classical meaning of a Baal Tshuva was, because everyone basically was, used to be in before pre-modern times, everyone was Shomer Shabbos, but there were people who sinned. So a Baal Tshuva is one who, you know, repented for his sins. And this becomes a classic responsum of the Rambam, quoted over and over again until in some places, we spoke about this in the classes on Morocco with Rav Shalom Essas, it became standard, for example, in Morocco to convert people for the sake of marriage. It became standard in other countries as well. In Germany, they did it in order precisely because you don't want to have a situation where a Jew or Jewish man or Jewish woman marries a non-Jew. And that's obviously a terrible thing. So they would convert them. And I don't know what's considered more lenient, to convert for marriage or to allow someone to intermarry. I mean, you might, Reb Chaim Soloveitchik, as we know, used to be very lenient on when someone was ill on Yom Kippur. And they said, well, why are you lenient with Yom Kippur? And he said, he's not lenient with Yom Kippur. He's stringent when it comes to life and death. Pikuach nefesh. So you could say that this is really a stringency of keeping Jews Jewish. But whenever I read the responsa like this, and I could send to anyone who's interested, I mean, there's loads, tens and tens of tshuvot, of great rabbis, permitting conversion for the sake of marriage, you always wonder, I always wonder, well, what exactly did they require in terms of observance of the halakha? On the one hand, we know that people who convert are supposed to accept Torah and mitzvot. On the other hand, these are clearly people who are not going to be so religious. They are with a non-Jew, and if they can't convert the non-Jew, they're going to remain with the non-Jew, so we're not dealing with tzaddikim here. On the other hand, they would like the non-Jew to convert, but the non-Jew also is not really that interested in Judaism. The non-Jew is only interested in being with this person. Yet, the idea was that, and we've seen this already, that if as long as the person committed to be observant, the kids would go to the Jewish school, be part of the community, that was enough to convert the person, and you didn't need to start looking into details, and we've had cases where, you know, it was obvious to everyone that the person wasn't going to be observant, but the posek felt that if the person converting didn't state explicitly, I'm going to violate Shabbos or anything like that, you could convert them. And that's sort of a case like we have here. And Rabbi Abramsky ruled in 1922 that you could convert for the sake of marriage. And he quotes, you know, all the sources I just mentioned. He quotes the Rambam. This is in, I think he quotes the Rambam. Yes, he quotes the Rambam. So what do you make of this when you deal with his later position? It could be he changed his mind. As I said, I don't think that the two can be brought into line. Because if he's criticizing the London Basin for being lenient about conversions, and now he's saying that you have to be stringent, I don't think they can be brought in line. He even publishes an article after he becomes, I won't say Ab Basin, thank you, Dayan Beanstalk, after he becomes the leading Dayan, called Bein Ger LeGer, in which he explains his position. So, I mean, it isn't, I said before, I'm assuming that's correct. It is correct. He wrote about it. He doesn't say, I'm changing my view from earlier, but he explains his stringent view. And he begins by noting that we value converts, as we do value converts. Conversion is an unbelievable thing. He says that we do value them. However, he then moves from there into attack on people who convert, but not for the right reasons. converts who want nothing to do with Judaism, and it's all about marriage. And he refers to them as Geri. This is a nice pun. The Talmud speaks about Geri Arayot, converts who convert because they're afraid. There was a story there. The Talmud speaks about they were afraid of the lions, and, you know, they want to be killed. So they converted, and the whole issue is, you know, what's the status of these converts, Arayot with an Aleph? Rabbi Abramsky refers to the modern-day converts, which are basically pretty much all in his mind, Geri Arayot with an ayin. I can't do the ayin sound to make the difference, but in other words, converts for the sake of marriage or for the sake of sexual relations. In other words, they want to be with the non-Jew, and they're not authentic converts. He doesn't say, by the way, that the conversion ex post facto is invalid. On the contrary, he's talking about how we shouldn't convert these people because they're not going to be good Jews. And many poskim say the same thing. They talk about how you convert these people is a terrible thing because beforehand they didn't need to follow Torah and mitzvahs, and now you convert them and they don't follow Torah and mitzvahs, and now they're in a worse situation than before because now they're being punished. They're going to receive a punishment for all the mitzvahs, let's say the Shabbos violation, everything, whereas before they didn't need to observe Shabbos. But all these poskim assume that the person's really Jewish, and that's why it's such a bad thing to convert them. Because now they're in a worse situation than before. Today, most poskim seem to say that, no, they're not. It's not a problem because they're not Jewish to begin with. But the assumption years ago, when I had in one of my Svarim blog posts, I gave numerous examples of this. The assumption was that these converts are Jewish. And that's the problem, that they were converted under false pretenses. And now we have Jews who don't care about Judaism, but they're Jews. So it's bad for them and it's bad for us. If these people weren't Jewish, it wouldn't be such a problem. It wouldn't be bad for them. They don't need to fast Yom Kippur. And it wouldn't be bad for us. And Rabbi Abramsky goes on and how this is, you know, this is terrible. And then he says, he goes further. He says, and if the person who, then if the couple divorces, the person who converted wants nothing to do with Judaism anymore. And we know there's plenty of cases like that. People who convert for marriage and then they divorce the next year. They're back at the Christmas tree and everything. But it really, you know, if it wasn't a good conversion to begin with, then it's not an issue. But the bad thing is that, as he's saying, that these people now have nothing to do with Judaism. The only reason they were at all involved because they were married. And then he cites, as an example of this, he cites from Leviticus, from Vayikra, chapter 24, verse 10 and on. It speaks about the son of an Israelite woman whose father was an Egyptian, went out among the children of Israel. And it says the son of the Israelite woman blasphemed God and cursed, and they brought him to Moshe. I mean, it gives a story here in the Chumash. And Rabbi Abramsky, even though this is an example of someone with a Jewish mother, he gives us an example of how he extrapolates this to conversion, that if people are not really part of the Jewish people, that is, they don't really feel like they want to be part, it creates all sorts of problems. So this is the beginning, I think we can say, of the London-based in having a very stringent attitude towards conversions. I've known people who, from England, one in particular, who converted with the London-based in, an old friend of mine, and it was very important to him to convert with the London-based in because he knew that, this is before all the revoking of conversions of the last few years. This is going back to, this is about 89 he converted because... even in those days, he didn't want to ever be challenged wherever he went. He was more in the Haredi world. He didn't want to be challenged about his conversion. In fact, he came to my house for Pesach in 1987. I was in Oxford that year, and I came home for Pesach, and he came home with me. And the question is, you know, for Shabbos, there's no problem having a non-Jew, but for holidays, it's a problem, a halachic problem, making extra food. So it's a problem when you have, although people have non-Jews for the Seder all the time. It's not so, as we say in yeshivas, it's not so pashut. But we asked Diane Arentro, and Diane Arentro said if he was there a day before, then he's sort of as a part of my household. That was the first time I ever saw this idea that he would, every Shabbos, he would violate Shabbos. He was very frum. I mean, he's frummer than me, that's for sure. And every Shabbos, he would, when I say frumer, I mean, you know what frumkeit is. He was new to it, so there's a lot of frumkeit. But he would violate Shabbos by doing something de'oraisa. It's not so easy to do de'oraisa. Most of the stuff we violate would be de'rabanan. what if you light a match or something like that? He was always careful because of the idea that a non-Jew is not supposed to observe Shabbos. And I mentioned already, though, that it's not all poskim accept that. There's a view that this only applies, if you look at the Rambam, there's only a prohibition for a non-Jew to observe Shabbos if they're observing it as like to create their own religion, their own Shabbos. But many poskim say if a non-Jew is observing it simply because they're in training, that they're not creating a new dot, a new religion, there's no problem with them observing it entirely. But he must have been under the guidance of the London Basedin in that. So once he is appointed to the Basedin, relations between him and Rabbi Hertz have ups and downs. I'll talk about Ben Elton's evidence that Rabbi Hertz really wanted him on the Basedin. I haven't really spoken that much about it. What I mentioned was that the United Synagogue at first didn't want him, and then they brought him in. But they did have ups and downs. For example, I heard this, although I haven't seen it documented, I heard this from Louis Jacobs about the difficult relationship that Rabbi Hertz had with Rabbi Abramsky at times. Diane Beanstock says that the relations were good, but I am not sure, maybe he'll email me, that he's quoting Elton, and he quotes Elton. I'm not sure if that, I mean, Jacobs lived through the period, and he knew Abramsky. And he told me that Diane Abramsky once said to him that Hertz exasperated, you know, because Hertz would want to do things, and Diane Abramsky would say, you can't do it. And we'll see in a few minutes some of the things where Rabbi Hertz would be, unless he's super tzaddik, I think he's going to be quite offended by what Diane Abramsky did. Once exasperated, this is what Hertz told Rabbi Abramsky, and Jacobs heard this from Abramsky himself. He said to Abramsky that, you know more Talmud than I'll ever know, but I know things you'll never know. So in other words, Rabbi Hertz was telling Rabbi Abramsky that don't think you're so much greater than me. Yes, you know more Talmud, but there's lots of things I know that you'll never know, which is true. Hertz was a PhD, you look at his chumash, he knows all sorts of things. But don't sell Rabbi Abramsky short. Rabbi Abramsky knew things, including things outside of Talmud and Halakha, that Rabbi Hertz did not know, which you would not find with the typical Dayan. We'll see this in a few minutes. But here's an example of how, of the sorts of things that Rabbi Abramsky and Rabbi Hertz would not see eye to eye. At Hertz's 25th anniversary celebration as chief rabbi, as well as there was a coronation ceremony for King George VI in 1936. This is after Edward's abdication. I'm sure many of us have seen the movie that came out a couple of years ago about King George. But in both these events, both the Jewish ceremony in honor of the king and also the event in honor of the 25th anniversary of, let's see, Chief Rabbi Hertz. I can't remember now what year he becomes Chief Rabbi. He's already Chief Rabbi by World War I. I think it's 1913. Maybe someone could check and tell me. So the 25th anniversary would be 1938. Rabbi Yecheskel Abramsky refused to attend either of these events because a non-Orthodox rabbi was also speaking. And that's not at all surprising if you think of for the King George's, the celebration honoring King George. But even at the event in honor, celebrating the 25th anniversary of Chief Rabbi Hertz's chief rabbinate, they had a non-Orthodox rabbi speaking. And I could see, by the way, why they would do this even from a, quote, from perspective. At this time, the chief rabbi was still recognized as the chief rabbi of all Jews, and there was big problems with the reform. Hertz battled with them. There was issues about should they have the right to perform weddings and all sorts of things. And in order to keep them happy, in order to keep them from pushing issues like this, that they should have the right to have their own, what they call marriage registrars and things like that, and there was fears that they would actually want to approach the government, that they should be recognized as a separate entity. If the idea was to keep them in the fold, and part of keeping them in the fold, officially at least, was by, you have to make them happy by not snubbing one of their leaders and inviting one of them to say some words about Rabbi Hertz. After all, it would be a lot worse if it was the 25th anniversary of the Reform Rabbi to have Rabbi Hertz come and speak. That's very problematic. and we know, or at least some of us know, about all the problems that Rabbi Jonathan Sacks got into when he went to the funeral of an esteemed Reform rabbi. But if it's the other way around, if it's the Reform rabbi coming and speaking about how great Chief Rabbi Hertz is, that, I don't know how much problems you could have with that. You could see why that would not be such an issue, but Rabbi Abramsky thought it was an issue that you're going to have, especially in an event of the Jewish community, or an event where the chief rabbi is being honored, to have a non-Orthodox rabbi, thank you, Scott, 1913, to have a non-Orthodox rabbi stand up and give a speech. You're giving him honor, you're giving him respect. And we see the same things today. I was at the Yeshiva Chovei Torah installation of Rabbi Lopatin, and there was all this attacks against the Chovei Torah. And believe me, there's things to attack. If you disagree with Chovei Torah, there's plenty to attack if that's not your perspective. But this was such nonsense. The fact is, they had a little panel beforehand. There was no theology, anything spoken. They just were asking people like Arnie Eisen, head of the seminary, and David Ellenson from the Reform, what they think are problems of American Jewry. That was the issue. And YU does the exact same thing. In fact, YU, they would have, until recent years, until Rabbi Lamb was ill, they had private meetings with select members of the Kollel and faculty and Rabbi Lamb, with people like David Ellenson and others, to hear the other side. But I didn't know it was such a problem to have to have a Reform rabbi explain what he thinks the problems facing Judaism is. It's sort of like an academic type of talk. It wasn't like, it wasn't theology or anything like that, but you saw the reaction and the attacks against that. And that was Rabbi Abramsky's perspective. Look, for the more right wing, the very idea that you even will listen to what a Reform rabbi has to say, even if it has nothing to do with Torah, even if it's about general things, that's something they can't stomach. Privately, they do. Privately, they'll meet with them and everything, but to actually have them speak publicly, that's unacceptable. So there was Rabbi Abramsky and Rabbi Hertz did not always see eye to eye. I can't imagine that when they invited Rabbi Abramsky to come to this event, that they thought that he would turn them down because they had a Reform rabbi who, as I said, the Reform rabbi was going to be talking about how great Rabbi Hertz is. But even that is a problem for some people, and I understand it. If you see the Reform rabbi as a mumar lahachis, as someone intentionally destroying Judaism, to give him a pedestal, even if it's to praise a rabbi, that could be an issue. In this time, Rabbi Abramsky comes in 1935. A few years later, you have Kristallnacht, you have the problems of the German Jews trying to get out. Rabbi Abramsky was very involved in helping Jews find, in Germany, rabbis, that is. The way it worked is, Hatzalah, is the different groups looked out for their own. The revisionists looked out for the revisionists, the labor Zionists looked out for them, and the rabbis looked out for the rabbis. If you looked at what the Vaad Hatzalah did in America, the Agudas Rabbanim, and what Rabbi Herzog did, they tried to find visas for the rabbis. And that's just the way it is. Should it have been that way? I don't know. But that's the way it is. People look out, just like you look out for your own family, you look out for your own ideological compatriots, you look out for the Rosh Yeshiva, we're trying to bring in yeshiva students, and that's how it worked. And Rabbi Abramsky was very involved in helping rabbis and other people who he had connections with enter Germany. What did this mean, he was involved? He was a go-between between the Jews that he knew on one hand and the chief rabbi and also other important people. He knew important people in London. He was very well respected. He learned English quite quickly. He would go. He was able then to be an intermediary to try to have visas issued so these people could enter England. Generally, Jews were not allowed in during this period into England. There were exceptions made. You had children. There was kinder transport. And various rabbis were allowed in. Now, there was certain times you can get people in if an important person made the inquiry or interceded. The same thing went on in Palestine. The same thing in America as well. Now, this all stopped when the war began because then the Jews couldn't get out. They still could come to America, actually, or go to other places. Even in America was not at war in 1940, if you could get out. But once England declares war on Germany, you couldn't come to England. You could perhaps come through other countries if you were able to get out, but you cannot directly come. There wasn't a consulate in England, so it made it much harder. I know someone who got out of Germany in 1940, went to Holland, and then from there to Shanghai. So you could still get out in 1940. But England's going to war. Obviously, the entire country is mobilized for this. Rabbi Yecheskel instituted something that, as far as I know, was never done in any large scale in World War I. It might have been done in a small scale, although I've never seen evidence of this as well. Soldiers would issue their wives divorces before going off to battle. It was actually not a divorce at present. It wasn't a conditional divorce either. It gave authority to the Beistin for the divorce to be given at a future time. Actually, I shouldn't say to the Beistin. I'm forgetting the details now. It might have been an individual might have been appointed under the auspices of the Beistin to actually give it. But authority was given to give a get if a soldier went missing 5 years after the soldier went missing. There were enormous aguna problems, classic aguna problems in World War I. I say classic aguna problems because we have a new concept of aguna today. It used to be that aguna was one whose husband disappeared. Either he went across the sea and no one knew what became of him. If you look in the newspapers, American newspapers, you always had these ads taken out. Mrs. So-and-so from Kiev, her husband came to America in 1905. Has anyone seen him? Or in war times, they were missing, or the husband just abandoned the wife. Today, we have a different type of aguna. Everyone knows. We know where the people are, and they just refuse to give the get. And that's a new type of aguna, but it's still an aguna situation, and the prenuptial agreement of the RCA is designed to avoid this. Unless you've been living under a rock, you've read about the situation going on between two important rabbinic families, where Moshe Feinstein's great-grandson, Reuven Feinstein's grandson, refuses to give the wife a get. And it's a big story in and of itself. But so we call her an aguna, and there's other examples of aguna. We don't have many cases of the first type of aguna, the classic aguna, because the world is so small today, people don't disappear like they used to. And even when in 9/11, what do? They use DNA. I mean, that would be a case where maybe it would have been a hard thing because you can't prove necessarily that the man went into the buildings, towers on that day. But now with DNA, and even without the DNA, they would have been able to free these wives because most of them called home and there was evidence that they went in. They would have been able to free them. But that would have been the case, a real case of an aguna. But as I said, when people think, in fact, so much so that if you speak to the average person and mention the word aguna, they will assume that the definition of an aguna is not the man-made aguna, it's not the classic aguna, but it's the man-made aguna, the husband who refuses to give his wife a get. Take my word for it. Go out and ask me what an aguna is. They'll say a man who refuses to give his wife a get. For the sake of historical accuracy, we need to point out something which maybe make people a little uncomfortable, but it's the truth. And that is that this, today we have this conception, and I think it's the proper conception, and the Rabbinical Council of America has this view as well, that as soon as the marriage is broken down, even if one of the partners, let's say the wife, wants out, as soon as the civil divorce is settled, a get has to be given. And if you don't give it, you're declared someone who's making your wife an aguna. Because today, if you tell a woman that you can't get a get, most of them, the ones you hear about, are the very pious ones. Because the typical woman, especially even many from Orthodox world, after a few years of this, it's the hell with this. They're just going to find a boyfriend, and they're going to move on with their life. And we know the problems that's going to create halakhically. The ones we read about are the real, we have to say, they're in today's day and age, they're real tzedekas, that they're not moving on with their life. If you look at the New York Post story, the Donaldson story, all you have to do is read the comments there, especially from Jews, saying, this is idiotic. What do you care about, a piece of paper? Just move on with your life. But historically, that wasn't the case. Historically, just because the wife wants out of the marriage doesn't mean that she can get out of marriage. That wasn't the case in secular law either. That, just because you want it out of the marriage. It's not like today where we have a different conception of this. We don't believe in holding people captive and all that. But there are plenty of responses in pre-modern times where the wife wants out or even the husband wants out. And the rabbis say, absolutely not. Why would the wife want to be with the husband if the husband doesn't want to? For all sorts of reasons. Primarily because what's she going to do about money? She'd rather be married to this guy. She doesn't have any money. She has no skills. What's going to happen? So we have, in pre-modern times, we have plenty of examples of rabbis who decide that what today we would call an aguna situation is not an aguna situation. The wife decides she doesn't want to be married. So what? There's a rabbinic expression. She put her eyes on someone else. She doesn't want him anymore. She has no valid reason just because she decided she's tired of him. Doesn't matter. The husband has no obligation to give her a get. And that's part of the problem today, because the people who don't give these gittin, they usually find rabbis who justify it for them based upon the old perspective. And there's a Beis Din in Muncie that any man who doesn't want to give a get, you can go there and they'll write the reasons. And it's not as if they're making it up. They're writing just like they're in the 16th century. I in one of my blog posts, I even put a tshuva responsum up there where a man chased around his wife with a knife. And the rabbi refused to force him to give a get because, well, even though he was chasing her with a knife, we told him not to do it again. So we have cases where the husband beat the wife. And the rabbi said, well, okay, unless he does it again, you can get a divorce. But for now, that's not enough of a reason to get a divorce. So it's not so clear historically that, the way we consider it is aguna has always been the case. This, by the way, so getting back to Rabbi Yechezkel Lubomsky, this idea he had, which was to prevent agunas, very important, was later adopted, his idea, by both the Agudas Rabbanim in America for American soldiers and also the chief rabbinate of the land of Israel, because you had soldiers in what was called the Palestine Brigade, and Rabbi Herzog and his Beis Din arranged the same thing, that they should give these conditional gets. I don't know if it was ever needed, as I don't know if any of these people who gave the get, plenty of them were killed, but usually when people are killed, they're killed. I don't know if it ever was needed, that is, a person went missing. Israel does not do that as a matter of course as far as with soldiers all the time. Before the war times, I don't know if in all the wars, but there have been wars where they did do that, the chief rabbinate, but they don't do it for all soldiers. And I asked about this, and they said because it would hurt morale. The reason I asked about it is because you had cases, for instance, like the Dakar submarine that went down. That was an aguna case. We've had other cases with the kids who were, one of them was married, I think, who were captured in Lebanon in the first war. They did not have any of these. You can get it if you want, but they don't do it routinely. But I believe in one of the wars, so maybe it was the Yom Kippur War or the Six-Day War, that there was a routinely the chaplaincy came to the soldiers and asked them. No one was forced to, but asked them to do this. So this can be checked. It's not hard. During the war, by the way, I don't know if it's the United Synagogue office, the Beis Din office, the office where the Beis Din was actually bombed. There's a famous story that Rabbi Abramsky went there. He had to get the papers. You need these documents. That's the proof of all sorts of important marriages and divorces. But for leave that aside for now. Something interesting happened in 1942, and that's Rabbi Chaim Moser Grzinski, the great Rabbi Chaim Moser, dies. In 1940, he's not killed by the Nazis. He's still able to be brought to a Jewish grave. He dies, and in 1942, Rabbi Yechezkel Abramsky publishes a small Sefer Zikaron memorial volume. I bring this up because I think this is the first Sefer Zikaron, the first memorial volume published by a typical traditionalist type of East European Jew. The German Jews, the German Orthodox Jews, had published these sort of things, but I don't know of any other such work published, Sefer Zikaron, prior to this. And about 10 years before that, there was a Sefer Yovel for Rav Shimon Shkup. That was the first Sefer Yovel published by traditionalists. Again, in Germany, the German Orthodox, they were publishing stuff like this. They had no difficulty. Sefer Yovel for Rav W.C. Hoffman. But this was a novelty, to publish a Sefer HaYovel for Shimon Shkup, a great Rosh Yeshiva. And Rav Chaim Moser mentions it, that this is a novelty, and he explains why in the introduction to it. I only bring this up because, if you recall, Rabbi Yechezkel Abramsky came up with a reason why we shouldn't celebrate the Rambam's, the anniversary of his birth. And because it was a novelty, all the reasons he gave, but he published the Sefer Zikaron. The State of Israel was established shortly thereafter. And he publishes an article in English in the Jewish Chronicle. He could write English. I'm sure his English was checked over by his sons, but he definitely read English fluently, and he published an article in English. And he writes that the return to the land of Israel is a wonderful thing. It's been the hope of Jews for generations. So there's no dispute that this is a great thing. He also says that after the Holocaust, there's no question that Jews can no longer be caught in the middle of every dispute. And every time there's a war or something, Jews are in the middle. Every time there's a dispute, Jews need their own country. So he affirms that, unquestionable, without any question, that Jews need their own country. However, he then explains that despite what I just mentioned, the reason why the Zionist movement met with so much opposition in the Torah world, that is pre-World War II, even though everyone agreed that you know, it's a great thing that Jews should return to the land of Israel, yet why did they oppose the Zionist movement? Because the Zionists were set on creating a new type of Jew, not bound to the Torah, a new type of identity. And therefore, Rabbi Abramsky says that in the pre-war years, many great Torah scholars opposed Zionism, and they didn't feel like it was so necessary to go to the land of Israel. Because, yes, the land of Israel is something that we all want to go to, it's great, but since, you know, it's being, you know, it's being dominated now by the non-Orthodox, as Zionism is a majority non-Orthodox movement, there's no need for us to mix in with that and create problems for us. We have a strong Torah community in the land of Israel, in Europe. There's no danger for Jewish continuity in Europe. And therefore, as long as the Zionists are running the show in Europe, in the land of Israel, we're going to stay away from them. In other words, there's a certain sense, Rabbi Abramsky says, before World War II, to being opposed to Zionism. If there were no secular Zionists, then everyone would agree it's time to return to the land of Israel. But since the secular Zionists, he doesn't talk about the idea, well, the reason the secular Zionists are running the show is because the Orthodox never, you know, got on the bandwagon. He just takes it as a given that there's no problem with Jewish continuity in Europe. The Zionists want to create a new type of secular Jew. Therefore, that explains why he doesn't say that he agrees with this, but you see that this is his sympathies. He's trying to explain why the Torah world in large measure opposed Zionism, and it's very obvious that he's identifying with this position pre-war. However, he says that everything changed with the Holocaust. There is no longer Jewish continuity in Europe. There's no longer a center of Jewish life in Europe. He admits, just like Rabbi Soloveitchik would later write about, that the state of Israel is a defense against assimilation for Jews in the diaspora. Even the secular state is important for Jews in the diaspora. And for that reason alone, he says, that it will be a barrier against assimilation, it will be supported by Orthodox Jews. Rabbi Soloveitchik says the exact same thing, that if it wasn't for the state of Israel, after the war, assimilation would have reached enormous levels. I mean, Jews were beaten, they were defeated, they had no... I mean, if there was, there had to be some sort of nechama, comfort after the Great Churban, to come out of the Holocaust with a third of the Jewish people just exterminated, and then with nothing, and still living in Golos, and still with nothing for you, that would have led to a terrible loss of confidence in what it means to be Jews, and a terrible rejection of Judaism. The state of Israel gave people pride after the war. That's what Rabbi Soloveitchik says. You should come back now and see with the Pew survey that that only gave people, we see, for three or four generations. It doesn't do it anymore. Rabbi Abramsky says the same thing, that the state of Israel was very important to stop assimilation. But he raises the question, is the real problem, despite this good aspect, is secular nationalism going to replace Jewish tradition, Jewish Mesorah? He deals with the issue of separation of synagogue and state, religion and state, because the state of Israel is just established, and there's all sorts of talk, you know, what should it be like? There wasn't even a constitution for the state. There was a few people came up with constitutions, but none were accepted. Some people wanted a separation of synagogue and state to a limited degree, some wanted more. He's opposed to it. And he says that in other countries, in European countries, obviously thinking about America, separation of church and state means that the government is neutral in religious matters. And that, he leads us to believe, he'd have no problem if the state of Israel would be neutral. However, he says, in Israel, it won't be neutrality, but separation of synagogue and state will lead to an anti-Torah public square. Remember, we're speaking of an era where the Orthodox were really a minority. All the politicians, the Labor Party, the people running the country, were not Orthodox. Many of them were anti-Orthodox. If we have a separation of synagogue and state, that will mean that the public square won't be neutral. It will be entirely dominated by the anti-religious elements. Therefore, it's vital that we have, no work on the Sabbath, public offices open on the Sabbath, all these sorts of things, because that's the only way that there will be some Jewish feeling and connection in the state is if it's by law instituted. Not surprisingly, he states, typical theme in Haredi writers, that not just Haredi writers, that although we're very happy with the creation of the state, its future depends on its attachment to Torah ideals. And that if it's just going to be another state, like all the other states of the world, then we can't have any confidence of its survival. His view of Eretz Yisrael, the land of Israel, is actually seen in a small booklet he published in London in 1945 called Eretz Yisrael, Nachalat Am Yisrael. The land of Israel, the portion, the inheritance, the thing that belongs to the nation of Israel. Let's translate it that way. And it's reprinted in his collected essays, Kovetz Ma'amarim. And here he sounds very Zionistic in 1945. When I say Zionistic, I mean Haredi Zionistic. We want to use an anachronistic term because I wouldn't use the word Haredi in 1945. But for what he becomes, let's call him Haredi, but Haredi Zionistic. And I say Zionistic because of the way he places Eretz Yisrael at such a central focus. Look, on page 4 he writes as follows. The situation of the Jews is unique. Questions of nation, religion, and land are tied one to the other in a way that has no equal in any other nation, religion, or land. And the whole point of this booklet is to show the centrality of the land of Israel. This isn't Satmar or anything like that. You're a typical non-Zionist. For Satmar, it's anti-Zionist. You don't return to the land. We're not really that interested in the land of Israel. Those who live there, fine, but there's no need for aliyah, nothing like that. There's no obligation. There's no mitzvah even. You don't fulfill any mitzvah. For the non-Zionists, it's also, the Eretz Yisrael is nice, but there's no obligation, it's not central to our identity, anything like that. Rabbi Yechezkel Abramsky is writing how Israel, Eretz Yisrael, not the state of Israel, Eretz Yisrael is central to our identity. So it's sort of like a Haredi Zionism of sorts. I see it's already just about 10 o'clock. So I'll stop here. I want to continue with this booklet a little, and then... we should finish next class, but I have some very interesting things, especially in contemporary things, which we'll be able to include next class, God willing, with Rabbi Yechezkel Abramsky. For those of you who are in Toronto, maybe I'll see you this Thursday night, where I'll be speaking on Rav Avadya Yosef, and I think I'm speaking 7 or 8 different times throughout the weekend, so I hope to see some of you old friends. I even see... someone, he knows who I'm talking about, so I don't need to mention his name, who we enjoyed a wonderful trip this summer to Italy. So I forget what show he is in. I'm not going to mention his name. One of my Toronto friends. So I'm not sure if I'll be with you, but maybe we'll see each other Thursday night, or I think I'm speaking Saturday night as well. And others as well, I see. I know recognize from Toronto. So with that, I will end. Take a few questions. If there are any. Yisrael says his funeral, Rabbi Yechezkel Abramsky's funeral, is attended by 40,000 B'nai Brak, one of the largest in its time. How did he become so popular over there in retirement? Please hold off on this to next class. We haven't even reached Eretz Yisrael. Next class, we'll see his aliyah and how he became so popular. And I wasn't even going to speak about that, but you can please remind me next class and I'll mention that. Now 40,000 is nothing. If someone's on Arbach's funeral, was 200,000. I mean, Orthodox funerals are giant. And as I will say Thursday night, Rav Avadya Yosef's funeral, what was it, 700,000? And let's, 800,000, let's say 700,000. I mentioned this already, but I'll just repeat it. I mentioned this the very first class this semester. If you look at the pictures, it's all men. And forget the Arabs. And forget anyone like under 10 years old. You're talking now with, of between 20 and 25% of every man in the state of Israel was at that funeral, which is an unbelievable thing. Did his friendship with Rav Zevin endure? 100%. We're going to come back to that. Next class, though. Save this for next class. They had a reunion. He didn't see Rav Zevin until he came to the land of Israel. And they picked up where they left off. His volumes on the Tosefta Gibshuta are simply by, not by topic, they're by tractate. Some of the volumes, are, when they say 24 volumes, it's not actually 24 volumes, they're combined together. So you have on Tarot, you have, his Tosefta is about 10 volumes or so, and then you have, I don't see where they get 24 volumes, that's not true. What they're doing is that, the person who gave that number, maybe you saw on Wikipedia, if you go to, for example, the Harvard catalog, you might come to that, but it depends how it's organized. At first, he published some volumes separately, but then they were put together. And now the standard set today is they put the Tosefta, you buy, let's say, Zeraim is in two or three volumes, and they're all put together. And then he has other things. He has a couple, they're not called volumes, but when he was head of the Beis Din, let's say, or I shouldn't say it, when he was senior dayan, he published a number of tshuva, which were published. Those are not really volumes. Those are small, more like booklets and things like that. The Tosefta, of course, is done by tractate. He finished the entire Tosefta, yes. So anyone who wants to learn Tosefta, you need to use him on Kutshim, on Tarot. There are no other comparable works. He wrote essays in his Kovetz Ma'amarim. A number of essays are published, and then they have essays which weren't included in there in the various periodical literatures and things of that. Okay, everyone, it's already. I need to be up very early tomorrow because we're expecting a snowstorm beginning in New Jersey here. I'm in New Jersey only 2 hours, less than 2 hours, an hour and a half from Philadelphia, an hour and 40 minutes, and they got 8.5 inches of snow yesterday. We got like 1 inch, but we're expecting snow tomorrow, 2 to 4 inches. Now they're saying closer to 4 inches, but it's not supposed to come start coming until about 9 or 10, so I got to get up and leave very early to make it to Scranton, because Scranton is supposed to start around 7-ish, so hopefully I'll be in Scranton by 7:30, so it's time for me to go to sleep now. Thank you all for joining us this week, and hope to see you next week as well. Good night, everyone. And good night, Neil. I didn't see you on before. Neil also was with us in Europe. But good to see you. And Mel, of course, and others as well. Jonathan, who I mentioned or alluded to. Good night, everyone.